You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, fat grams, or anything else so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life. That is my wish for you. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. So as you know, I rarely have guests here on the Dr. Nina Show. I am super picky about that because I only want people who are very inspiring and who add value to your life. And that is why I am so excited to introduce you to my next guest who is here today. Dr. Maggie Landis is a board certified physician, public health nutritionist, and anti-diet wellness expert. Yes. She helps women who are exasperated with chronic dieting to live a full and unrestricted life, pursuing their personal passions without the distraction of rigid eating behavior. She's also the creator and host of the Eatfluencer podcast, where she and her guests dig into the mindset work required to construct a healthy, complete, and high-quality life, unlimited by the oppression of diet culture. Ooh, I love that. Maggie believes that by empowering ourselves to have confidence and control of our thinking and leaving behind our obsession with dieting, we can show that value to the world. Yes, yes, and more yes. Welcome, Dr.
Yes.
Maggie.
Well, thank you, Nina. I'm so glad to be here. I appreciate that really generous introduction.
Well, look, I appreciate your mission and your perspective, and I appreciate you here sharing this with us today. So let me ask you this. Have you always been anti-diet?
No, I have not. And I will be the first to admit that. I've practiced medicine for almost 20 years. And up until about 5 years ago, I was heavily in diet culture, both personally and professionally, because that is really normative. That is the normal lens of practicing medicine or just being an adult woman in the United States specifically. So no, I have not always been here. It was a transformation of thinking to arrive.
So tell us, how did you go from there to here? What was that transformation?
Right. Well, in a really encapsulated version, I was diagnosed with cancer. And in my cancer recovery, I studied a lot of nutrition, sort of like an independent study, we can call it that, because I was sure, this is in my diet thinking, that there was like one perfect human diet and I was the last person on earth who hadn't found it, right? So I started, and I mean reading PubMed articles and not looking at Instagram. And I realized there's not science to support what I'd been repeating to patients and families for decades, essentially. And I went back to graduate school, got a graduate degree in nutrition, and really came to realize where the evidence is and where it is not specifically. And that's my mission now.
I love that. And isn't it interesting, once you dig into the science, which I did, you know, for my first chapter in the Binger, it's ditch dieting, and actually how dieting causes weight gain in the long run, how artificial sweeteners also cause weight gain, how calories are not equal, all of these myths that we've been taught to believe.
Right. Well, the average consumer is reading labels and headlines and I mean, they're not reading PubMed articles. Let's just be honest. Nor do you and I expect them to do that. So they are dependent on what professionals put forward in terms of fact so that they can get the right information. And there's a lot of reasons that they may not be getting an unbiased perspective from, you know, my interest, of course, is specifically in clinical medicine. But the same could be said with fitness professionals or therapists or, you know, anybody that's working in this. Their education was probably biased. Their personal opinion of these topics is probably biased. And I'm not here to shame any professionals, but there's a lot wrong with the system that built the culture.
The And it's also a $60 billion culture.
Oh, yeah.
$60 billion industry.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's like a lowball estimate. It's probably more than that. And that's only in the United States.
Yes.
And this is a global problem. We want to talk about a pandemic. This is a serious pandemic. So the issue is diet culture. And I know you've explained many times what that kind of means to your audience. It's a business, full stop. It's a business. And frankly, they're pretty successful business. I mean, I'd love to run a business that made $70 billion a year, right? So would you. So
by selling the illusion that if you just lose weight, you're going to have some perfect life.
Yeah. So we need to understand where that's coming from, that it's not a healthcare model. It's not a mental health support. It's not wellness advocacy. It's not any of those things. It's not public health. It is marketing. And they're free to do that. They're free to do that. But where I really get, you know, burned up on these issues is where they are doing it under the brand of healthcare, because that's wrong and that's deceptive. And that's where I find my fire to do these things. And I know you do too.
Yeah. So I think the misconceptions that many people have is that you could tell whether someone's healthy by just looking at them, by whatever, you know, that you can actually measure health on a scale.
Right. That there's like a visual for health.
Yes.
Right.
So how about, that's another myth I think you'd be good at busting. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. Well, health at every size, which is a, you know, movement kind of started by Dr. Bacon and her book and those sorts of things. But it's essentially the idea that health and health promoting behaviors can occur in any size human, small, big, or otherwise. And so to pursue health means to pursue those actionable things that lead to health. And we can make a big long list of what those things are. Weight is actually not on the list, because I know everybody can name people in large bodies that are healthy, have normal blood pressure, normal blood glucose, normal insulin, normal this, that, the other. Their risk of having a chronic disease or dying is low or even lower than other people. And then there's people in small, lean bodies who are wrecked on the inside for a variety of reasons. And so we have to uncouple the belief that weight and health are synonyms, because they're different words. So are we talking about weight, or are we talking about health? You know, in my opinion, in healthcare, we should be talking about health. And it's hard to separate. And I don't blame anybody for being in this headspace, because we have been conditioned by decades.
Programmed. You know?
Programmed. Yeah, that's a good word. Programmed.
Yeah.
Exactly. And like I said, the average person who's getting information from a dietitian or a doctor or whatever, you know, they don't realize the bias that's and the influence that's built into the information they're getting. And so that's what I really like to deliver clarity to people, so they can understand. And then you can make the decision. If you choose to pursue weight loss and dieting, you are free to do that. But I want you to have with clarity, understand what the likely outcome of that is going to be.
And so when you encourage people to stop dieting,
right,
how do you go about that? What is the first step?
Because it's sort of, that's scary. A lot of people are, and I'm sure your clients too, they're sort of like, okay, so what? Because there's a lot of security in dieting. There's a lot of control and a lot of familiarity in what we've done forever. So just saying stop it is not always like a real effective way to.
It's scary. People say, oh my gosh, I'm going to just totally lose control and eat everything.
Right.
If I don't go on a diet, I'm going to be completely out of control. Or they'll say, I just don't know what to eat. If no one's telling me what to do.
And to make this in its most simplistic form, really the practice of intuitive eating is where you want to get to, but it's not something that you just decide tomorrow. I'm an intuitive eater. Here we are, flip a switch, and my life is different. It's a process of, I actually like to say it's a process of unlearning. And I say that because most people hearing me talk or you talk this message, they are full of information. They have so much in their heads, they can't even conceive of one more thing they have to learn to do because we're just spent. So when you frame it like it really is, which is a unlearning of diet culture as much as it is a learning of intuitive eating, then it seems like, okay, I can consume this. But the general bottom line of intuitive eating and the idea of not dieting is that you as an individual make decisions and you have feedback from your body, and there's the body is so complex and dynamic and fantastically way smarter than any of us. And it knows what to do. You have to have a belief system that the body knows what to do. It just does. And whether you believe in divine design or whether you just believe in some darn good engineering, it has to work. I mean, the body has to work. So when you can get to the space where you and your body are making the decisions, not an external influence, that's where we're going. And to make it real practical, the very, very first thing I tell people to do is neutralize their language around food and eating. That there's no more good, bad, clean, junk, all those words that we use, which are just colloquial descriptions of things we eat. That's the first place that you can take action and just sort of stop and say, you know what, this is not junk. This is actually a brownie. And this is not clean and holy. This is actually just asparagus. And you can start moving to a place where it's just food. And we're not ignorant of nutrition. We're not ignorant that there's different nutritional densities. But the problem when we classify everything, what we're really doing is giving food morality. That's the problem. It's just a thing. It's just a thing. And to go one step further, when you have that morality on something that doesn't really deserve it, and now you eat the thing, now you have transferred that to yourself. So now the brownie's not junk and bad and sinful. You are, because you ate it. And that is, I mean, then you're in the weeds, right?
Then you're in shame.
Yeah.
Then you're in guilt and shame. I feel so bad about myself because I ate a brownie. And the more that you demonize brownies and glorify asparagus, the less attuned you are to what you really need. And then, of course, the anticipation of deprivation makes people want the brownie more.
Exactly. And so the starting point, it's not the end point, but the starting point is to just say, this is asparagus. This is a brownie. What do I choose to eat today? That's it. Like, one's not better, worse, holy, dirty, whatever. It's just a thing. And then you can start looking at food and nutrition objectively, because that's what we really want to do, is be a little more objective and not under this emotionally charged. We're sort of like it. That's, and I know that because I did it for decades, as I'm sure you did, as many other people that are listening have or are still doing. It's just exhausting to not just eat food, but to have the food be this whole emotional burden.
Yeah, to think about it all the time. People want to lose the obsession and the preoccupation and the planning and the thinking and the reviewing.
Oh my gosh. The bandwidth that it takes out of your life that you could be spending doing a million other things that serve you way better, that's a relief. I mean, that's the biggest relief. And that's really where people, you can get that win early. You know, that, like, this is a process to learn, but that particular kind of winning happens very early. You don't have to do this and quit dieting for very long to realize, wow, I got a lot more time in my day. I don't have to track everything that goes in my mouth on my iPhone. I don't have to, you know, it's really freeing.
And of course, sometimes that's the problem, because it can distract people. This is more like the psychological element of it.
Sure.
If you're worrying about what you're eating, you're not worrying about what's eating at you. But
exactly. And I love that. I know you say that all the time, and I love that, because that's really the foundation of that, is we're using all this diet control as a means to avoid the emotional work that we need to do. Because food is a legal, easily accessible distraction.
Yeah.
And we do it. And yeah, it works. So I just like to separate. I mean, there's so many components of this. I just think people, the first step is to become aware. They don't even realize where we are. It's like, I make the analogy all the time. It's like, if you asked a fish what it's like to be underwater, what would their answer be? They don't even have an answer, because even though they live in the water, they don't have any idea what it's to like not be underwater. And that's like kind of like, what's it like to be influenced by diet culture? Most people that are our age have no idea, because they don't know any other way. It starts with young children. The way that we teach our toddler age kids how to eat at the table, and the way we bribe them with certain foods and stuff, it starts that young. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I remember taking my kid to the dentist. You know, she's 3 years old. And as when she leaves, there's the bowl of candy. You go to the dentist and then they give you candy.
Yeah.
A reward. And of course, you know, then they get cavities and it brings up more business. But you're absolutely
pretty good business model right there.
Yeah. And she recently told me that she couldn't eat, we'll call it Captain Crunch. She couldn't eat it. It was her favorite thing, but she wouldn't let it herself eat it because it was bad. So she would binge on it. And I said, well, why don't you just eat it? Like, if you want it, just eat it. Like, there's a concept for you. And so she did. And she ate it and ate it and ate it. And then one day she said, you know what? I really didn't want it. And I realized that what I really wanted was a salad. You know, and she would never have thought that when she was enmeshed in that deprivation diet culture, because it separates you from you.
It seems almost magical and fantastical to think that your body will actually give you good cues on what to eat, but it does. It does. And so that's a perfect example, because the restriction, and I know you work a lot with binge eating disorder and clients that have binge eating issues. And the number one reason that happens is because of the restrictions we place on ourselves. And then once you allow things, that emotional charge, that kind of magnetic pull towards it just goes away. It really is bizarre how that works. You have to have a trust in Dr. Nina and I telling you that's how it works, and just do it for yourself. And then you'll be like you said, your client, you will eat all of it the first day, because it's like, you know, there's a pendulum that swings back and forth. So you've been pulled this way for so long and then it stops in the middle. Obviously there's a little sort of honeymoon period, or, you know, overshooting the center point, whatever you want to call it. But eventually your body knows what to do. It does.
Yeah. And it's trusting your body, and trusting that your body is a part of you, rather than being in a battle with your body and being against your body and trying to whip your body into shape, which is, you know, a fight between you and your body. But you and your body are not two entities. You're one.
And you have one. You have one. That's it. No matter what you do to it, or how you treat it, or respect it, or disrespect it, you have one. So it's kind of like an arranged marriage, honestly. You don't get a choice, but you do get a choice how you interact with it. So let's do something positive for ourselves.
I love that arranged marriage idea. That's so perfect. I love that. Well, if anyone would like to join the conversation and talk with Maggie, the number here is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. We'd love to hear from you and to hear any questions you have or any thoughts you have about the conversation that we're having right now. Yeah.
Yes.
It's so important.
Right.
What about this idea of there are more and more diets? Every year there's a new diet. Every single year there's a new diet. And yet people's health is declining and declining and declining. In fact, you know, I think I read a statistic about heart disease, that it's been going up and up and up, even though people are actually having less sugar, less, fewer of these foods that you would think would lead to health problems. What's going on? Why are we going on diet after diet after diet and our health is getting worse and worse and worse?
Right, exactly. Well, and I, you know, I do not like the word obesity. I do not like the term obesity epidemic. I think there's a lot of bias and sort of charge in that. And that's a whole other show. But, yes. You know, the issue is we have a dieting obsession. And the reason that more people are having all these, you know, adverse health outcomes is partly or mostly as a result of the dieting, because that's what they've shown to do. I mean, there's no, to my knowledge, I have not read a single well peer-reviewed, vetted academic paper that shows the pursuit of weight loss and weight loss focused diets have any health benefit outside of maybe a year. Or at the longest, maybe 2 years. They're short term, because that's the only little window of time that they win. And so that's what gets published. But we're not in it for a year or two. I'm not, at least, hopefully, you know. So I don't think you should do anything that you're not willing to do forever, because that's the only way this is going to work out for you.
And it's a lot easier to eat intuitively than it is to diet and be in this toxic relationship to yourself, food, and your body. So we have a guest, and I know, Carly Gash, I know you called. If you want to call back, I was going to get to you as soon as we had a break, but I see you left, but please call back. In the meantime, we have Josh is on. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Hi, thanks a lot. Yeah, I was just listening and I really liked what you guys were talking about. And the only thing that I was going to add was, you know, we tend to value maybe dieting or whether we should fast or not if we have a problem in taking food in. And those things, and arguing that way actually makes the problem worse. I think I read that Stephen Gross talked about how arguing about these things can make it worse. And I was just saying that the unconscious is what we really should be focusing on, just from listening to Dr. Nina talk about the unconscious. Yet we tend to argue about just food. And she says that every day, but I just kind of wanted to say that.
Thank you, Josh. You actually brought up a really good point, which is intermittent fasting, which is all the rage now. Intermittent fasting will cure everything. It'll make you lose weight. It'll cure cancer. It'll do everything. And people point to, these studies and that studies. Of course, you know, we can also point to studies that say the opposite. So I would like to take this opportunity to ask you, Maggie, about your thoughts on intermittent fasting.
Yes. Well, thank you. And thank you, Josh, for your contribution and your question. So, you know, here's the truth. Intermittent fasting with a lowercase I and a lowercase F, we're all doing it. Okay. Unless you are hooked up to like continuous tube feedings or something, you are intermittent fasting. Like Nina and I, we're fasting right now. We're not eating right now. So the issue is that so intermittent fasting in a generic sense is what we are all doing as humans. That is what humans are designed to do, is eat intermittently. Now, diet culture, in order to sell you something, because that's not real sexy to sell something that we're already doing. So they have to brand it and make a capital I and a capital F and come up with something, you know, that they think is revolutionary, and then market it with either apps or books or programs or whatever it is. The truth is, your body will tell you to intermittently fast if you're listening to it. And I'm talking like the little IF. There's no reason to get neurotic about, well, I do 16 and 8 and I do 18-6 and I do 23-1 and blah. Okay. That's a diet culture marketing lens. So, the body's designed to intermittently take in food. And my argument is that you will do that in a, you know, healthy pattern if you're just listening to it. I mean, we all know that we do that, right? So like when you go out to a big dinner, you go to a big event and there's lots of food and all this sort of stuff. I mean, I can tell you from my perspective, like 99 out of 100 times the next morning, I'm really not that hungry. So I may either not eat or not eat a large meal or whatever, eat later than I normally would. That's intermittent fasting the human way. But that doesn't make you any money if you're selling it. So they have to, you know, and they have to capitalize on it. Because like we said before, it's something that's business. So that's kind of my thing about it. There are benefits to not continuously eating, but none of us are continuously eating anyway. So really, we're all intermittent fasters.
Yeah, breakfast really means break fast.
Right, that's like the root of the word, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really a, you know, so it's not, there's no advantage to subscribing to some rigid plan. Because once you decide you're going to intermittently fast, and I'm going to do the 16-8 or whatever, now you can't listen to your body anymore. Because what happens when you're hungry during your, you're not in your window? And I used to do this, like in a diet culture way, I used to do this. So I know exactly how they talk. They talk about their window and all this sort of stuff. So you no longer are listening to yourself. You, all of a sudden, it's an external cue to eat or not eat. And that's not where we want to be. So the body will do it itself, in summary.
You know, I was just going to say that you were saying listening to the body. And I feel like sometimes the body tells us, not wrong things, but we have to have a deeper understanding of what the body might be saying, maybe.
Well, and I agree with that, because there is a lot of emotional, psychological work that we disguise as food problems. I mean, that's Dr. Nina's entire platform, really. And we do need to do that work. Yes, I 100% agree that that's true. We use all these little superficial things as a distraction from really sitting in the place that's uncomfortable for a lot of people to unpack our psychological needs. But if you want to fully be healthy and really kind of recover from dieting, that's required work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Josh. Thanks so much for calling. And Carly Gash, I invite you to call back if you'd like. But Josh, we really appreciate your question and your thoughts. And I absolutely agree. It's so interesting that the experience of yearning, and of course in our culture, and I talk about this all the time, like we talk about being hungry for love or starving for attention, and the experience of yearning and wanting connection can sometimes even be expressed physiologically.
Oh yeah, there is a complete mind-body connection, and I know you appreciate that. It's real. It's not this metaphysical kind of woo-woo experience. It is really hormones and neurotransmitters and biology.
Yes, and Carly Gash, we have Carly Gash on. Welcome to the show, Carly Gash.
Hi, Dr. Nina. Hi, Maggie. Do you hear me well?
We hear you. Yes, we hear you. You can maybe speak up a little louder.
Awesome. That's maximum what I have. I'm calling from the phone. I'm kind of in the car. So I have a question about this intuitive eating. Honestly, I'm very scared to do it. My whole life I wanted to do it, and I did it when I was a kid. But then everything changed, and now I'm not sure how to distinguish intuitive eating and just binging. Because like, if I don't think, I'm not being mindful of how much I'm eating, I'm just binging nonstop. But at the same time, I started recently listening to my body, and it kind of regulates itself. I feel, for example, sometimes I'm not even hungry, but I start like overthinking it. Like, for example, I don't want to eat. It's already 12 p.m. I'm still not hungry. 1 p.m. I'm not hungry. And then I say, I need to eat something. Otherwise, I will be hungry in the evening. And I'm going to eat a lot of food in the evening. And then I won't be able to sleep well. So let me put something right now to digest it, so it doesn't disturb me in the evening. But then it never goes smooth. Like I put something and then I'm worried. It's just a lot of worry about it, because I really don't know how to eat. What's good, what's not. Like people say, don't eat a lot of food before you go to bed. But then if I don't eat much, sometimes I'm so hungry that I cannot sleep, or like I get all anxious. So what's the right way? Like, because if I listen to my body, I cannot listen it very well. If I just listen it, I just eat nonstop and I gained weight in pandemic and I'm like freaking out. So that's the question.
Those are great questions, Maggie.
Yeah. So I want to just validate what you're saying, because I think, Carly Gash, what you're saying represents what many, many, many people are thinking and the experience that they've had both in the last year and also through their lives. I want to point out one thing you said that is really provocative to me. As you said, I used to be an intuitive eater when I was a kid and something went off the rails and I don't know what happened. That is exactly right. Okay. We are intuitive eaters. Like if you think about a baby, literally a baby, breastfeeding baby, that is the quintessential image of an intuitive eater. All right. They have no thought about calories and macros and the clock and all this stuff. They eat and they demand feedings when they're hungry. And when they're not hungry, you cannot make a not hungry baby eat. You just can't. I'm a pediatrician. I am a mom. You just can't do it, right? So
yeah,
we were all there. Yeah.
When I was a kid, I did that. But then in my family, I was force fed, you know. I remember like how I didn't want to, but adults, they still made me eat. And I had even this vomiting, you know, my body couldn't take it. Because I remember when I was a kid, I didn't like eating much, like if I was not hungry. But because I was force-fed, brainwashed, it became like not a habit, but already like a very ingrained behavior, acquired behavior though. But like, even though I don't want to eat and my body doesn't want to eat and I feel that I'm not hungry and putting food will just make me suffer because it's just excessive food in my stomach and it will make me sluggish and tired and just pain in the stomach, you know. But I still go and just eat it on top. But that's all psychological, like, I understand.
Yeah, it is. And your experience going from a child through that, and your parents were well-meaning. They were probably told if you didn't eat a certain amount, you would be unhealthy, you wouldn't grow, you wouldn't be smart, whatever they got information from. Yeah.
It was my grandma. My ethnicity from Kazakhstan. We went through hunger and people were eating each other. So it was a big deal for older generation. Coming from like out of hunger, it was just very, food is cherished and they were just scared. So she kind of said, here I also see a lot of people like that, like parents or grandparents who just feed their kids. Well, it's their expression of love or bonding or whatever. They just don't know how to correctly raise kids. So they do just what they know, but it doesn't made my life easier, you know. I suffered from it and now I have to deal with it. So maybe better not to touch kids, just let them be.
Well, in my opinion, yes, is to not unprogram them. They're intuitive eaters, so let's not unprogram them. The analogy I make is that this intuitive eating is in all of us. It's like a dimmer switch on a chandelier, okay? You know what that is, where you turn the light down real slowly and then you turn it back up. So everybody, every human, including patients with binge eating, including patients with eating disorders, including patients with psychological baggage and everything, they have that there. It just may be that their dimmer switch is really, really turned down so they can't connect with it. And so the process of learning intuitive eating and kind of unloading all that diet culture noise in your head is where you recover that dimmer switch and you get back. You don't have to do anything different. You just need to stop, covering it up with this cerebral exercise. We all have made eating this academic, intellectual exercise, and it wasn't intended to be that way in the first place. So you'll get there. And I'm so happy that you're, you know, participating in this conversation. The fact that you even have an awareness of what's going through your mind, you're ahead of 99% of the people in the first place. So you're off to a very good start.
Maggie, honestly, it's Dr. Nina's help. I've been doing Nina's programs for like about 3-4 years. And definitely whatever clearer thinking I have now, it's totally like Dr. Nina's help, and I'm so grateful. Before I didn't think like that. I was totally lost in this diet culture. I was scared, anxious. It was just so much anxiety because, you know, everyone is shouting from different angle what to do, what to eat, what not to eat. And I'm coming from like CIS countries, which is like Russia, Kazakhstan area. Over there, we women are hugely shamed, hugely fat shamed. If you're not skinny, it feels like you don't have the right to live, you know?
Right. And well, it's no different in the United States, honestly.
Here it's like, I'm coming from the gym right now, and here women wear, like women with any size, they wear short shorts, you know, like crop tops. And here it's a little bit easier. I think like women here can breathe a little bit more, you know. Whereas over there, if you are a little bit like more than medium size or like S size, and you wear like short shorts, you can get a comment like, oh, you're too fat to wear this. You know, like very nasty stuff. And it's getting better right now. I left it 6 years ago. Maybe it changed. I don't know. But, you know, it's just, we need to stop doing this.
It's just crazy, so much pain. I love that you want to stop, and thank you for calling. And I would also encourage you to not do that to yourself, because sometimes we avoid the way other people treat us and look at us, and yet we do that to ourselves. So my encouragement would be to do that. And the only other thing I want to say is that you mentioned eating now so you wouldn't be hungry later. And I want to, so that's sort of preemptive eating. And, you know, Maggie, I want to get your thoughts on that, of, you know, this fear of being hungry. Tell us about that.
Yes. And, you know, there is this misconception that intuitive eating means every single time you eat, it is this kumbaya sort of sensory experience, and everything has to be from the heart. And that's not true. We have to go to work. We may not get a lunch break for 6 hours. You're traveling. There's all sorts of reasons why I kind of call that practical eating, you know, because you do have to, in those situations, forecast, you know, maybe I should eat a little bit when I'm not quite as hungry as I normally would eat, but because I know I'm going to be on an airplane for 6 hours or whatever it is. So that's just being sensible. And the problem is we take that out of context, and we do that day to day to day, when that attitude of practicality is not really necessary. We can, in general, we have the opportunity to be more flexible. And then those kind of rigid, well-planned moments can be the exception rather than the rule.
Thank you so much for your call, Carly Gash. I really appreciate you joining and sharing some provocative thoughts that I think a lot of people can relate to.
Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I was going to say the piece with kids, you know, and I have a lot of kind of skin in the game because I'm a mother, I'm a pediatrician, this is a big deal. And so one of the reasons I want particularly adult women to understand this is because the influence that we have on kids when we, the way we talk and the way we role model behavior around food influences them before they are even verbal, before they even like, you know, that, and that sort of thing is so important to break this cycle. And you don't have to be a mother. I mean, most people have some interaction with children somewhere. You're a coach, you're a teacher, you're an aunt, you're whatever is, you know, church, youth group, whatever it is, you know, just the way that the language we use, the way we handle these things around kids, we have the opportunity to break this cycle so that, you know, I know you have a daughter, Dr. Nina, I have a daughter. I don't want our daughters to be on a podcast in 30 years having the same conversation. I hope it's over for them. I really do.
Yeah, I think it's changing. My daughters are 14 years apart, but the one thing that I did notice when each of them were little was when we would go out, people would say, like, oh, you're so beautiful. You're so pretty. Oh, you're so beautiful. That's all she heard. And yet if we were with like a little friend of hers who was a boy, it would be, oh, you're so beautiful. Oh, you're such a little man. Oh, you're such a tough, strong boy. Like they would talk about the inner qualities of being a boy versus the way my daughter looked. And this is what our culture does. We have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Pamela.
Hi, Pamela. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question for Dr. Maggie?
Well, I don't have a question, just something that I've learned over the years of eating is that I've learned to listen to my body and to say, like, when I'm when I'm hungry, it's time to eat. And then, you know, I've also learned to say, okay, I'm full and it's time to stop. But, you know, sometimes we have to learn to listen to our body to eat. And then what happens is that I've noticed with me is that when I'm not hungry, but I'm, you know, the emotionals come up, is that that's when I start eating, you know, like, but you have to, you know, because you were talking about listening, you know, or not, what is it called? Intermittent eating,
fasting,
you guys are talking about. Yeah. And, you know, you just, it's hard to, you know, it's like every person says they know their own body. And so I've learned to, you know, but my drawback is like, you know, the emotional stuff is I've learned to eat it out. And I think that's what the problem about, I don't know some people, but that's what the problem is with me, is that I just don't feel, like you say, feel it, and you just eat it. So, but that's the big key, is to recognize when you're hungry, when you're full. I mean, because there's times that, you know, I've had a big lunch or a late lunch, and when it comes to dinner time, I'm not hungry, you know, and I'll say, no, I'm not going to eat tonight, you know, and watch TV and go to bed, you know, but I'll be hungry in the morning to where, you know, I need to eat something because I've gone so long without eating. So that's a big key also, is people have to learn when to say, I'm hungry and I need something to eat, and learn their bodies.
Yeah, absolutely. And emotional eating is an area of interest for me. I feel like this is a major place where people get hung up when they're thinking about food, is emotional eating. And it sort of has this real negative connotation. Eating is supposed to be emotional, and there's a lot of reasons why that is that I'm not going to go into detail here, but if it wasn't supposed to be, somebody would have invented some little nutrition pills and we would just swallow them in the morning and then it would be done, and we wouldn't have food at weddings and we wouldn't sit together at dinner. We would just sort of like not be emotional about it. So it's supposed to be a lot of things. Eating is supposed to be a lot of things besides just straight up nutrients going in the body. But the problem we get into is when you eat reflexively because of your emotions, and I know exactly what you're talking about. It's often because you're bored or stressed or tired or sad or upset or something.
Right.
The first issue is to talk about why we're eating. But then in my opinion, the bigger problem is then what happens next? Because then what happens next when you say, oh, I ate because I got in a fight with my husband, and now I'm just a big fat pig, and now I'm going to just eat the whole thing, and now I am going to just, I'm never going to buy this again, and now I'm going to restrict, and I'm going back on a diet tomorrow, and all this. That is where the problem is. The problem is really not from you eating a little extra or eating something that you don't normally eat because you're mad. The problem is all that that follows that leads you into this restricting and binging and sets you up for a way more likely to do that again. And I know you understand that because it sounds like you've have some recognition of when that's happening, which is great, because just kind of stopping and saying, okay, so what? I got in a fight with my husband and I ate some ice cream. Okay, it's over. It's just ice cream. Remember, it's not good or bad. It's just ice cream. And it's over. And you're going to figure out how to reconcile with your husband, and then it's over. And not entering this emotionally charged cycle of, now I have to restrict. Now I'm mad at myself. Now I have shame. Now I have, because that's bad. That's a bad place to be.
Yeah. And it leads to more eating for comfort.
Right?
But some people do that, you know, and because I've been overweight I've always been having problems with food, is that I've learned that, you know what, you know, you're going to go by it. You know, I'm not going to feel guilty for eating that, because it makes it even worse. You know, I grew up with a Jewish grandma who was the queen of guilty. You know, who would make you feel guilty. And so I
are we related? Not to feel
what?
I said, are we related? I had a similar Jewish grandma, so
yeah, I'm telling you. And you know, it's funny because my roommate, she's a friend, but I don't talk to anymore, but my roommate tries to do the same thing. And I said, when did you become a Jewish grandma? You know.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I have learned not to allow her or my grandma or whoever or the food to make me feel guilty, because I'm going to do this. I'm going to eat it. I'm going to eat it. And I'm not going to feel guilty for eating. Okay.
Exactly. Because it's the guilt is the problem. If you respond to negative emotions with overeating or binge eating, creating more negative emotions around it is just like pouring gasoline on a fire. And, you know, yeah, exactly. So nipping that in the bud is where it has to start.
Pam, thank you so much for your, call. I am so glad that you were able to join us. I just have one quick question that we want to get to from Instagram, because I think it's a good question. Kylene is saying she's learning to eat when her stomach is growling. Is that the only way her body can tell her if she's hungry?
No, that is not the only way. And that is sort of the common way. That's how we teach little kids, like, when your stomach is growling, that's when you're hungry. But, you know, what I like to tell people is you have to really figure out what the signs of hunger are for you. And it's a little different for some people. That GI tract noise and that empty feeling is the feeling. For some people, it's a little lightheadedness. For some people, it's just even almost they can have an adrenaline surge where they actually feel kind of like a higher level of energy when they're about to be really hungry. There's a lot of ways. And the best way to figure this out, if you want to sort of figure this out practically, is eat till you're full. Okay. Just eat a normal meal and then start figuring it out. So like an hour later, think to yourself, how do I feel physically right now? And then, okay, 2 hours later, this is what I feel. And you keep making note of what's going on in your body over the course of 2, 3, 4, 6 hours, whatever time up till your next meal, and sort of make a list, if you have to, of what hunger means in your body. And then you can start looking for those signals. So that's a great question.
Yeah. We only have 2 minutes. So I'm going to ask this really fast. This is from Sharon. What would you suggest for a teenage boy who is very overweight, likes spaghetti, pizza, hot dogs, and burgers? He is not interested in fruits and vegetables.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but the basic thing is, don't restrict, because that's going to fuel the fire. So you want to add good things and a variety of things. And it doesn't matter if they're toddlers or teenagers, you have to just keep exposing them to nutrient dense foods over and over and over, and they will eventually be adopted and, you know, kind of take part in a well-balanced diet. I hate the word well-balanced, but for lack of a better word.
Well, it's better than unbalanced.
Yeah, that's true.
Well balanced is what we're all looking for.
That's true.
Yeah, I cannot believe we're at the end of our show. This has been such a really rich conversation, and it's so good to hear from you. You are a diet disruptor.
Right. Yes. And well, thank you for inviting me. I have had a great hour with you too.
Well, we need to have more diet disruptors. And Maggie, I'd love to have you back on the show sometime, because I can tell that people have more and more and more questions. And we sort of skimmed the surface, even though we got deep. So
yes, I'd love to.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That is our show for today. I'm here every Wednesday at 11 on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio, or you can listen later on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you see your podcasts. Thank you so much. And by the way, if you love the show, please leave a comment or a rating, actually both, leave a rating and a comment, because the more that we get, the more people that we can reach and the more people that we can help become diet disruptors. It's a movement.
That's right. That's the mission.
Anti-diet. I'm the anti-diet revolution and you're the diet disruptor. And between the two of us, let's just change the world for the better.
Let's do it. We're doing it.
We're doing it. All right, everyone. Thanks so much and have a good week. See you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.